Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 23 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet, novelist and librettist Ron Butlin explains the role of the Edinburgh Macar, describing how he came to the job and his varied experiences as a civic poet in the Athens of the North. Following Ron, the poet and magazine producer Jerry Cambridge speaks briefly with Conor McPhee about his route into writing, living simply, and the pleasures of editorship. First up, here's Ron Butlin.
Being Edinburgh Macar is quite an unusual position. People ask sometimes what the Macar is, you know, and I do find myself very often having to explain that I'm not a builder, but actually the poet laureate for the city. It's not really a job. You don't get paid, for example. There is a minimum, very minimal fee, I should say, which is called an honorarium, which just rather neatly covers our council tax for the year. But in general, it's more of an opportunity and an honour, a very great honour for which I'm very grateful. I'm the third Edinburgh Macar. Prior to me was Stuart Conn and then Valerie Gillis. And when Valerie was coming to the end of her period as Macar for the city, it's a 3-year tenure, to my complete surprise, I answered the phone one day and I was asked if I would consider becoming the third Edinburgh Macar. I was gobsmacked, to be honest, and didn't take me very long, just in fact about 3 seconds, and I just said, oh, I would be utterly delighted. And we talked for a little bit and hung up, and then I never heard anything about it for about another 5 months, and I thought maybe it had all been a dream. And then I received an official letter, and gradually things began to move. And it started off with just doing sort of PR more than anything else, where I was interviewed by a couple of newspapers, run down what my favourite colours were and, you know, favourite music and favourite this and favourite that kind of thing, which is not the sort of thing I do normally. And then I was installed in June 2008. It was a wonderful ceremony that they'd put on in the city chambers there. And I met the provost, met everyone, and from then on, I was the Edinburgh Macar. I wondered what I'd be expected to do, and I gradually found out that I really wasn't expected to do very much at all. Occasionally, I was asked to give talks. I've learned to give speeches, to say a few words, as we say. That was something I was a bit unsure about, but in fact, I've now taken on board, in fact, rather like doing. And in fact, it's been so successful that very recently, after I gave a spontaneous talk at a dinner, this guy came up who runs an agency for after-dinner speakers and said, would I like to sign on his books? Another rather unexpected thing was being auctioned. And I've twice been auctioned. The first time was just before I became Macar. And I think it must have been all part of this sort of run-up to get publicity. But I was auctioned for a cancer charity. And the idea was that the person that paid the most money would get to go for afternoon tea with me. Which that's a very strange kind of concept altogether. And I wondered how I would get on being auctioned, you know. I had to stand up, show myself to the audience so they could see what they were getting for their money. And my wife, Reggie, very tactfully said, look, if it doesn't go right, I'll bid as well. So even she thought it wasn't going to work out, perhaps. But ultimately, in fact, I went for nearly £600. And had a very delightful afternoon tea as well, into the bargain. And that got followed up a few months later at Christmas, where I was asked if I would auction my creativity. The idea being that there would be an auction, and then the person that paid the top fee would then be able to set a theme, and I would write a poem for them on that theme. And as the bidding started, I thought, oh, my God, it's going to be some big corporate businessman. And what is he going to ask me to write about? You know, sort of in praise of tax avoidance or double entry bookkeeping or something. Oh, my God. And to my amazement, the guy who eventually paid, and paid well over £600, shyly said to me, he said, "I've been married for 30 years. And every morning I wake up and see my wife and see that she is the reason that I carry on living. So could you please write a poem that expresses my love for my wife?" Which was very, very touching. Also, rather difficult because I never met his wife. However, I drew on feelings for my own wife and then presented him with the poem. The businessman framed it and gave it to his wife in a very touching ceremony. To move from the kind of nice bit to something completely different, I was imprisoned outside the Scottish Parliament to highlight the Day of the Imprisoned Writer. I was in a cage and I was locked, and people came and looked at me, and not all of them knew what I was doing there, so it was a rather strange day. There are all these different things, but I suppose the central core, or the one that people most think of, is the idea of commissioned poems. Now, at first I thought, my goodness, can my creativity be turned on and off like a tap? Can I just write about opening the new civic centre? Because normally I'm writing from, you know, quite deep within me. I have found the opportunity of doing this really to be very liberating. It's allowed me to write about things I certainly would never have thought about, like the gathering of the clans. That was a difficult one. Another one was a round-the-world clipper yacht race, where the crew would recite my poem wherever they landed, saying they were from Edinburgh and they were like ambassadors for the city, so I had to write a poem for them to recite. So there's been quite a few really interesting poems and subject matters that, as I say, I would never, ever have occurred to, and I found that very liberating. You can't spend all your life writing about the state of your soul. One of the nicest things that I had to do was to occasionally write poems just in celebration of people. And I did one very recently that celebrated the Scottish painter who based in Edinburgh, Elizabeth Blackadder. And she was made, well, it's actually called the Edinburgh Award. So I was asked if I would write a poem about Elizabeth and about her work. And in fact, it has now been officially calligraphied. Something that made me realise the kind of value of creativity was that shortly after I was made into Edinburgh Macker, in fact about a week or two after, my wife Reggie was diagnosed with cancer. A real shock. And we had months and months that are a bit of a blur. Going to the hospital, having tests, and then big radio, chemo, and eventually operations. Very, very frightening time. And in the midst of this, I was still being hauled out for Mackerman duties. In a way, the commissioning and the Macker role kept me kind of like in the real world. Where I really saw it working was where Reggie was rushed into hospital for an emergency operation. We didn't know what was going to happen, didn't know how it was going to end up. And Reggie got wheeled into the emergency room. And I was pushed into a waiting room and just told to wait. And about 2 weeks earlier, 3 weeks earlier, I'd been asked to write a poem by the Provost to celebrate vibrant Edinburgh. Well, as you can imagine, vibrancy was pretty short supply in our household at that point, and I just couldn't get my head around it at all. And as I sat there in the waiting room, suddenly the first line of this poem celebrating vibrant Edinburgh came. And then the second, and then the third. And my memory being what it is, I immediately had a scamper around the room to try and find some paper, and I was able to write in the back of it and begin to do the poem. And I really did experience just how art can be healing. It allowed me just to find a place where I could go, where I wouldn't go mad. And then afterwards, after I'd kind of, at least I got it started, then the surgeon came through, said everything was fine, go and see Reggie. And everything was wonderful. And her recovery started from then on. Being Macker has opened out all kinds of different possibilities. And one of the main things it has done is really shown me that there's no need to be so precious about work and think of it as just something that has got to, as I said earlier, be my soul laid bare for the world. It's nothing like that at all, at least not the way I've managing now to do it. I find when I'm asked to write something that instead of saying, God, I don't know anything about that, well, I go and find out about it. But then I would move to a different level and I would try and see if my imagination can embrace this and draw it, whatever it is, into its own world and then speak. It's important, I think, that art has the opportunity to have a public face like this. All too often we think of the Garret, the lonely voice. Well, it's pretty true, actually. Poetry can have this much more public voice as it used to have in the past, and to be a kind of chronicle and narrative and celebration of public events as well as private ones. For me, it's opened up all kinds of possibilities within my own creativity, and also it has been thoroughly enjoyable.
That was Ron Butlin. You can find out more about Ron on his website at www.ronbutlin.co.uk. Next, here's Jerry Cambridge in conversation with Conor McPhee. Jerry Cambridge is a multi-talented Scottish writer, photographer, designer and editor, equally well known for his lyrical and formerly fluent poetry and his exceptional harmonica playing. Jerry is the founding editor of the Scottish-American poetry journal The Dark Horse, a magazine that showcases excellence in both literature and print design. Jerry has taught widely in Scotland and beyond, and his latest collection is Notes for Lighting a Fire, now available in a second edition from Happenstance Press. So, Jerry, I'm wondering if you could tell us what your first art form was, the first way you expressed creativity as a young person.
I think the first art form was probably photography, I guess. And then from there I slowly developed an interest in writing. And it was through... I was constantly being told by editors that one had a better chance of selling photographs if you supplied editors with a complete package. So I began writing articles to go along with batches of photographs. And I specialised in natural history photography. And in time, I slowly became more interested in the writing than in the photography. And from there, it was a sort of natural progression to writing poems.
It's quite an ironic progression to start writing money as a sort of a breadwinning thing and then end up writing poems.
It certainly was, but I guess I got quite tired of, because I used to write a lot of, I was one of the youngest ever writers, regular writers, feature writers for the British Reader's Digest in the 1980s. I was in my 20s and I specialised in natural history subject, and I just began to get really weary of having to write constantly to a particular formula, because the British Reader's Digest, although I learned an awful lot from the about the process of writing from them, had a very, very strict stylistic guidelines and so on. So I think I gravitated towards poetry as being like a free arena where I could just express myself without any element of market forces bringing pressure to bear on what I might write.
It's interesting that as a writer you quite often write in form, in rhyme or in meter, so despite the fact that it's freer, there's also a sense of constraint there. I wonder if that sort of relates in any way to learning to write to constraints, or whether that comes from somewhere else.
I think that probably comes from advice I was given by early mentors. I know now there's a sort of paid mentoring procedures now, I guess, via the universities and so on. But when I was first developing as a writer, it was all much less official than that. So my early mentors were writers such as George Mackay Brown and the Galloway poet William Neal. And they kept advising me to try and write in meter and rhyme, because to learn the traditional forms of English poetry was a necessary apprenticeship to self within the art. So I think it was connected with that. But that was somewhat after I'd stopped writing regularly for Reader's Digest. So I'd thrown off the shackles of having to write to a formula by that point.
As a writer, do you feel like there are sacrifices that you've made in your choice of direction, you know, going from working commercially to working more creatively?
I suppose yes, but I wouldn't really think of them as sacrifices. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to start writing poetry now and that will be a way of becoming really poor. What actually happened was I just was no longer able to write the particular thing which was required of me for particular markets. I kind of just sort of bumbled my way into it, into the whole world of writing poetry. And I ended up living very, very poorly in Ayrshire in a caravan. And actually being at times almost bizarrely happy in that situation. My parents were both out of the Irish peasantry, and I don't say that with any sense whatsoever of demeaning them. They were out of a particular background. And my father had been trained as an engineer, and they were part of the Irish diaspora, but they moved around a lot in a caravan when I was young. So quite often when I go into schools and talk to school children about writing, I'll say to them, up until the age of 37, I'd never lived in a house. I'd always only ever lived in a caravan. So that's basically what I knew. So it wasn't, I didn't really regard it as a hardship living in under those circumstances. There was a sort of bizarre freedom to it because my overheads were so low at the time. I remember, for example, even when I left my caravan in 1997, my rent at that time was, I think, £14 a week, which was wonderful if you were a freelance, because you had such low overheads. And it just meant you were living so close to the ground that if you fell over, you almost didn't notice.
I mean, I must say that idea of a sort of a small private space like that, a quite minimalist space, probably appeals to a lot of writers. It might perhaps is easy for us to romanticise a simple life like that.
I think it probably is easy to romanticise, but in some senses I still feel, in terms of my sensibilities, if I'm still living in a caravan, really, it's like a default position that one switches back to, that minimalist idea. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by writers who have these periods in the wilderness, and I never heard of, you know. Alistair Gray's got this wonderful theory that all poets, for example, should go off and talk to sheep or thereabouts for about 10 years and then come back into civilization.
Now, after all those years in the caravan, you finally moved on to become a writer in residence down at Brownsbank Cottage. What was that experience like?
It was a bizarre experience. Fascinating, bizarre, because basically you're living in Hugh MacDiarmid's house, one of the greatest 20th century Scottish poets, not the greatest, but a contentious figure. You wake up every morning in his bed, you get up, and there are about 20 portraits of Hugh MacDiarmid staring down at you from the walls. You were expected, when I was there, to show visitors around the cottage. They were supposed to make appointments to come and see you, but quite often they didn't do that. And you're having to write your own work within that dynamic. So that was quite fascinating to me. When I first moved in, a lot of people would say to me, oh, you must be finding it really difficult in Hugh MacDiarmid's cottage, because it doesn't have a washing machine, you're not allowed to change anything in it because it's a registered museum. And I said, oh, no, I'm finding it quite luxurious, actually, because it was the first house I'd lived in.
Was it a source of pressure to suddenly be somewhere officially as a writer?
It was, and I don't know how you yourself have found this in residencies and so on, but after having just been anonymous for many years, for say 10 years, working as a poet, I suddenly found myself in a position of social responsibility. I had both a downside and an upside. The downside was that one felt one lost some of the necessary out-on-the-edgeness that I think some writers need to be able to function and write the work that they themselves can write. And the upside of it was that it was very interesting to be socially regarded and socially accepted and not regarded as being a maverick or out-on-the-edge in some slightly dubious way.
The idea of being an outsider is an interesting one, because a lot of writers do feel like outsiders, and I sometimes wonder if they become writers because of that sense of being outside the world they find themselves in, or whether somehow it comes with the territory, because to most of the world, being a writer seems like an odd and distant thing to do. You know, they know that writers exist, but actually meeting one is unusual. Mm. So you're somehow set apart anyway.
Yes, yes. In other words, you become an outsider by dint of wanting to be a writer.
Indeed.
By definition, because you almost have to be. Because I guess so much of writing is about trying to see the world clearly or freshly or unexpectedly. And to do that, you actually can't. You do have to try and differentiate the way you're looking at things in some way from what might be called the general view, if there is such a thing.
So one of the things you've been doing since 1995 is editing the magazine The Dark Horse, which you founded. Mm. And apart from its very strong aesthetic as a magazine, it's also a beautifully designed thing. Mm. And you've gotten into desktop publishing and digital design as part of that process. Do you get the same sort of satisfaction from that as you get from writing, or is it a different thing?
To some extent, it's a different thing, but I kind of regard doing The Dark Horse, or each issue of The Dark Horse, as being like a big poem. In a sense of my own making, really. It's all these different things are creative in their own ways. And I think it's the whole assigning essays, deciding on the balance of an issue, the layout of it, etc., all satisfies a particular part of oneself, which is similar to that part which might like organisation and language and so on. Although it has a very different effect. It has a kind of social, external side. Editing and a magazine is quite a public thing, whereas most writers' writing lives are solitary and private.
I mean, another thing that this must have brought into your life is a lot of technology, which as a writer you might otherwise have avoided. And it seems to me that one thing that technology is doing these days is really empowering individuals to do things such as publishing that would have been very difficult 20 or 30 years ago. And I wonder if you think this is a good or a bad thing for writers.
I think some of it is absolutely superb, and some of it is slightly dangerous. I wonder if it's slightly dangerous from the point of view, it's not dangerous from the point of view of the dissemination of writing, but I think from the point of view of the actual point of creation of writing, a lot of technology can be a distraction. I do think that a lot of the new technology is actually changing our how we focus, how we concentrate. If we still find it easy to engage with written texts in the same way as we did. I mean, I certainly know I got the internet in 1999, and I have noticed, you know, that you don't access texts in quite the same way as you did. So I wonder if that's changing. But in terms of the actual being able to get work before the public and make other people aware of it and generally distributing it, I think the internet, desktop publishing, the new design possibilities of desktop publishing and typography and so on are astonishing things. Used well, they can lead to all sorts of new possibilities.
Both of us have benefited from Royal Literary Fund fellowships, and it seems to me that the fellowships are a great way of supporting writers by obviously giving them some money, but also helping students with academic writing, and indeed helping academics with academic writing. Do you think this is a way forward for other kinds of arts funding?
I don't know. I think the RLF scheme is very singular, and I think other arts funding might be more inclined to try and take the more traditional route of tutoring creative writing. I think one of the very refreshing things to me about the RLF fellowships are that it's not about creative writing, it's about academic writing. I think to be able to help students like that is a wonderful thing, and it's quite an inspired idea, getting creative writers, so-called, into institutes of higher education to help with academic writing. It's the idea that poets, playwrights, and novelists may have skills which are of value in that other world. And I think that's the case. There was recently James Dyson apparently was talking about there weren't enough engineers in this country, and there were too many young women going off and studying French lesbian poetry. And Simon Armitage wrote a defence of poetry on this basis, that the mere focus on language closely can benefit hugely anyone's use of language, no matter what it is you're writing, whether you're writing job applications, CVs, whatever else it might be. Poets, for example, novelists, can give good advice as to how to actually improve that whole process for students. And I think that's been shown as part of the success of the RLF fellowships across the country.
So have you ever been tempted to write a novel or a play?
Oh, no. I think I've got somewhere in a suitcase somewhere, I've probably got a couple of terrible typed drafts of two absolutely absurd novels written in my 20s, when I was writing for Reader's Digest and had ambitions to write fiction. But oh no, I don't think so.
That was Jerry Cambridge. You can find out more about Jerry on his website at www.jerrycambridge.com. That's Jerry with a G. And that concludes episode 23, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 24, we have the second part of George Miller's interview with Jeremy Seal, exploring Jeremy's further adventures in Turkey. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.